From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now!
George Floyd's story has been the story of black folks because ever since 401 years ago, the reason we could never be who we wanted and dreamed to be in is you kept your knee on our neck.
On the 10th day of nationwide protests against police violence, thousands gathered for a memorial service for George Floyd, who was killed last week by Minneapolis police. We'll hear excerpts and speak to Professor Carol Anderson, author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide.
When I talk about white rage, I don't actually mean the Klan and the cross burning, because that's simple. We in this society, we know how to identify that. This is the much more subtle, the much more destructive type of racial violence. And it emanates out of Congress, out of the Supreme Court, out of state legislatures. And it's designed to, in fact, undercut black achievement, black aspirations, and black advancement.
We'll also speak with African-American filmmaker Chris Frierson. Police pepper sprayed him directly in the face while filming protests in Brooklyn. He was helped within seconds by volunteer medics as they struggled in agony. And we'll discuss the increasing militarization of the police with Stuart Schrader, author of Badges Without Borders, how global counterinsurgency transformed American policing. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minnesota, mourners gathered Thursday for a memorial service honoring the life of George Floyd, the African-American man whose death at the hands of Minneapolis police sparked a nationwide uprising against racism and police brutality. During the tribute, mourners stood in silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the amount of time police officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck as he pleaded for his life. 3 of those minutes, he was unresponsive. Reverend Al Sharpton read the eulogy.
What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
After headlines, we'll bring you extended excerpts of George Floyd's memorial service. In Minneapolis, the 3 officers charged with aiding and abetting George Floyd's murder were arraigned in Hennepin County courtroom on Thursday with bail set at $750,000 each. Defense lawyers told the court the 2 officers who pinned George Floyd to the pavement as Officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck were rookies barely off probation. But records show Officers Alexander Kung and Thomas Lane joined the department in February 2019 as probationary officers. They became full officers last December. Meanwhile, a longtime friend of George Floyd, who witnessed the killing, told Minnesota State investigators that at no point did George Floyd resist arrest before his death. He had been in the car with him before police officers took him out. There are new developments in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, the 25-year-old African-American man who was shot dead after being chased and ambushed by a group of white men in Georgia. After a hearing Thursday, a state judge concluded there's enough evidence to support the murder charges against the 3 men. During the hearing, Special Agent Richard Dial of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation testified one of the men used a racial slur after Arbery was chased, hunted down, and executed.
Mr. Bryan said that after the shooting took place, before police arrival, while Mr. Arbery was on the ground, that he heard Travis Michael make the statement.
Those last 2 words were the F word and the N word. Ara Bree's family is calling for all three men arrested to face federal hate crime charges as well. We will have more on the Ahmaud Arbery case later in the broadcast with Professor Carol Anderson. Massive protests against racism and police brutality continued in cities across the United States for a 10th straight day, with more demonstrations planned throughout the weekend. Here in New York, police used clubs to beat back crowds of peaceful protesters Thursday as they marched in the Bronx past an 8 p.m. curfew. The New York Police Department says it arrested 170 protesters citywide. They face the prospect of a lengthy stay in crowded and unsanitary jails after a Manhattan judge ruled the city could hold protesters beyond the state-mandated limit of 24 hours from arrest to arraignment. Earlier in the day, over 10,000 people packed a downtown Brooklyn plaza as Terrence Floyd led a memorial service for his older brother, George Floyd. The crowd erupted in boos and jeers as Mayor Bill de Blasio took the microphone. Bill de Blasio left the stage, many of the protesters turned their backs and chanted for him to resign. Speaking a short time later, New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams called on the mayor to address protesters' pain and anger rather than responding with more police and curfews.
I hear the mayor and the governor saying we have to do what we have to do to protect property. I want to say this as a citywide elected official. We must protect property. We must make sure people feel safe. But we're with the same energy for Black lives.
In California, police in the city of Vallejo fatally shot an unarmed 22-year-old man on Tuesday who was kneeling and had his hands up outside of Walgreens after officers responded to a call about an alleged looting during protests against the police killing of George Floyd. Police said they believe Sean Monterosa had a gun, but later said he only had a hammer in his pocket. Witnesses say when police arrived, Monterosa quickly dropped to his knees and surrendered when a police officer in an unmarked car shot him five times through his windshield. Monterosa grew up in San Francisco, had previously worked at a boys and girls club. In Buffalo, New York, two police officers have been suspended without pay after videos showed them assaulting a 75-year-old protester, sending him to the hospital in serious condition. In the videos, the elderly man, whose name has not been released, stands peacefully in front of a line of advancing riot police. Two of the officers violently shove him backwards. He falls to the sidewalk, striking his head. One of the officers motions as if to administer aid, but is pushed away by a third officer. About two dozen riot police look on as the man is left motionless on the ground, bleeding profusely from a head wound. The Buffalo Police Department initially told the local radio station, quote, one person was injured when he tripped and fell. Buffalo Mayor Byron Brown said in a statement he was deeply disturbed by the video. In Washington, D.C., thousands of demonstrators held a youth-led protest at the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Thursday, kneeling on the hot pavement for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the length of time Officer Derek Chauvin kept his knee pressed to George Floyd's neck. Across the mall, federal workers fortified a security perimeter around the White House complex, erecting a tall black metal fence and adding new concrete barriers. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Mark Esper has ordered several hundred active duty troops from the 82nd Airborne Division to leave D.C. He first made the order Wednesday, but then reversed himself, facing White House pressure. The Washington, D.C. chapter of Black Lives Matter and a group of protesters have sued President Trump, Attorney General William Barr, and other top officials for violently clearing out peaceful demonstrators in Lafayette Square outside the White House so the president could have a photo op on Monday. On Thursday, Barr defended the administration's actions and blamed extremist groups for instigating violence over the past week.
We have evidence that Antifa and other similar extremist groups, as well as actors of a variety of different political persuasions, have been involved in instigating and participating in the violent activity.
While Attorney General Barr singled out the anti-fascist movement known as Antifa, he provided no evidence of wrongdoing by the anti-fascist activists. This comes as The Nation magazine has obtained an internal FBI document that shows the agency had, quote, no intelligence indicating Antifa involvement presence at protests in Washington last Sunday. But the document did cite the presence of, quote, far-right provocateurs. In related news, federal prosecutors in Las Vegas have charged three men connected to the far-right extremist Boogaloo movement with inciting violence during the recent protests and conspiracy to commit terrorism. The three men all had experience in the U.S. military. Meanwhile, in Salisbury, North Carolina, police have arrested Jeffrey Allen Long, a 49-year-old with ties to neo-Confederate hate groups. He's charged with firing a weapon near protesters on Sunday. On Capitol Hill, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky proposed an amendment Thursday that would weaken a bill making lynching a federal hate crime punishable by up to life in prison. A day earlier, Senator Paul single-handedly held up the legislation by denying its passage on unanimous consent. The bill is co-sponsored by the Senate's three African Americans, Republican Tim Scott of South Carolina, Democrats Kamala Harris of California, and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker.
But I am so raw today, of all days that we're doing this. I do not need my colleague, the senator from Kentucky, to tell me about one lynching in this country. I've stood in the museum in Montgomery, Alabama, and watched African-American families weeping at the stories of pregnant women lynched in this country and their babies ripped out of them.
International press freedom groups are expressing alarm over the rampant mistreatment of journalists covering the protests over the past 10 days. Reporters have been shot with rubber bullets and pepper spray, arrested live on air, assaulted with riot shields. The Committee to Protect Journalists has compiled a list of 250 cases of press freedom violations. The ACLU of Minnesota has filing a class action lawsuit over the targeting of journalists. Meanwhile, journalists at two major papers are criticizing how their own outlets have dealt with the recent protests. On Thursday, more than 30 journalists of color at the Philadelphia Inquirer called out sick after the paper ran an article titled Buildings Matter Too. And at the New York Times, more than 800 staff members signed a letter protesting the publication of an opinion piece by Republican Senator Tom Cotton titled Send in the Troops. Many times, reporters tweeted out a message saying running this puts black New York Times staff in danger. Worldwide confirmed cases of COVID-19 have topped 6.6 million, with the global infection rate rising faster than ever. There are now over 100,000 new reported infections daily, likely just a fraction of the true toll. Over the past 2 weeks, twice as many countries have reported a surge in cases compared to countries that have reported a downward pattern. This comes as Brazil has overtaken Italy as the country with the third highest COVID-19 death toll. Brazil's health minister confirmed more than 1,400 new deaths in a single day Thursday, a record, taking Brazil's total to over 34,000. The U.S. has the highest number of confirmed cases by far and over 108,000 deaths, probably far, far higher. On Thursday, Robert Redfield, head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, told a House committee that many Americans are failing to heed CDC warnings that they should practice social distancing and wear masks in public.
We're very concerned that our public health message isn't resonating. We continue to try to figure out how to penetrate the message with different groups.
Redfield did not mention the president of the United States himself. The Huffington Post is reporting law enforcement agents have seized hundreds of cloth face masks that read "Stop killing black people and defund police." The movement for Black Lives made the masks to help protect protesters during the pandemic. Boxes of masks were mailed from Oakland, but they were seized in the mail by law enforcement. President Trump has taken new steps to gut the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act, citing the economic crisis caused by the COVID outbreak. Trump has signed an executive order to remove the environmental review process for major projects, including new mines, highways and pipelines. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court in San Francisco has overturned the EPA's approval of a popular herbicide made by Monsanto. The court found the EPA had substantially understated the risk caused by the product. Russia has declared a state of emergency in northern Siberia after more than 20,000 tons of diesel fuel spilled into a river near the Arctic Ocean. Following record heat linked to climate change, the permafrost beneath a fuel reservoir reportedly collapsed, leaking diesel across miles of Russian wilderness. Climate activists say the incident is the biggest oil spill in Russia's modern history. A shocking new report by the United Nations says tens of thousands of people in the Philippines may have been killed since mid-2016 as President Rodrigo Duterte unleashed a war on drugs, giving police the power to arrest people and use lethal force with near impunity. The UN report points to top government officials as instigators of extreme violence and a pattern among police of planting evidence in dozens of murders to suggest officers were acting in self-defense. Among the dead are over 70 children. The youngest victim was just 5 months old. And in Richmond, Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam on Thursday ordered the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from the state capitol after it was vandalized during recent mass protests. Richmond's African-American mayor, LeVar Stoney, welcomed the move.
We have two pandemics in this country, COVID-19 and racism. One is 6 months old, the other 400 years old. And as the events of the last months in the last 2 weeks have made painfully clear, both are lethal, especially for black and brown people.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thursday marked the first of many memorials for George Floyd. In Minneapolis, members of his family, loved ones, and supporters gathered for a tribute. Floyd's golden casket was covered in red roses. A picture projected on the wall above it showed the mural of Floyd that's been painted at the street corner where he died. The mural reads, "I can breathe now." During the tribute, people stood in silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the amount of time police officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck as he pleaded for his life. Almost 3 of those minutes, Floyd was unresponsive. This is one of George Floyd's younger brothers, Polonius Floyd.
It was just amazing. Everywhere you go and see people, how they cling to him. They wanted to be around him. You know, George, he was like a general. Every day he walks outside, it'd be a line of people, like just like when we came in, wanting to greet him and wanted to have fun with him. Guys that was doing drugs, like smokers and homeless people, you couldn't tell, because when you spoke to George, they felt like they was the president, because that's how he made you feel. He was powerful, man. He had a way with words. He could always make you ready to jump and go all the time. Everybody loved George. We didn't call him George. We called him Perry. If you called him Perry, you knew him direct, you know what I mean? Because George was the name everybody called him. Big George, Big Floyd, you know, Georgie Porgy. He had so many different names. But I'm going to go ahead and let...
I'm not stopping you.
I'm just, man, it's crazy, man. All these people came to see my brother, and that's amazing to me that he touched so many people's hearts, you know, because he's been touching our hearts, you know. You come to Third Ward, where we're from, people are crying right now. That's how much they love them. You know, I'm just staying strong as I can because I need to get it out. I need to get it out. Everybody want justice. We want justice for George. He's going to get it. He's going to get it.
That's George Floyd's younger brother, Polonius Floyd, speaking during the tribute Thursday in Minneapolis, where Reverend Al Sharpton announced he's joining with the families of people killed by police to organize a march on Washington on August 28th, the 57th anniversary of the historic demonstration for civil rights led by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. It's also the day in 1955 Emmett Till was lynched. Reverend Sharpton urged those gathered Thursday to stand up in George's name and say, "Get your knee off our necks."
George Floyd's story has been the story of black folks, because ever since 401 years ago, The reason we could never be who we wanted and dreamed to be in is you kept your knee on our neck. We were smarter than the underfunded schools you put us in, but you had your knee on our neck. We could run corporations and not hustle in the street, but you had your knee on our neck. We had creative skills. We could do whatever anybody else could do. But we couldn't get your knee off our neck. What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
That's the Reverend Al Sharpton speaking at the tribute to George Floyd Thursday in Minneapolis, attended by thousands inside and out. When we come back, we look at a hearing in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, the 25-year-old African-American man who was shot dead after being chased and ambushed by a group of white men in Georgia. We'll go to Georgia to speak with Professor Carol Anderson. Stay with us.
Though he'll never put more on, put more on.
Music from the memorial service for George Floyd in Minneapolis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, disturbing new details were revealed in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, the 25-year-old black man chased, ambushed, shot dead by a group of white men in Georgia in what many have called a modern-day lynching. In a nearly seven-hour hearing, a state judge concluded all three men, Travis McMichael, his father, former police officer Gregory McMichael, and William Roddy Bryan, would stand trial for Ahmaud Arbery's murder. After Special Agent Richard Dial of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation testified, Travis McMichael used a racial slur after shooting and killing Arbery.
And said that after the shooting took place, before police arrival, while Mr. Arbery was on the ground, that he heard Travis McMichael make the statement.
Those last two words were the F word and the N word. Travis McMichael had a sticker of a Confederate flag on his truck's toolbox. The investigator, Richard Dial, also testified the three white men hit Arbery with a truck as he attempted to escape them. Special Prosecutor Jesse Evans said Arbery was chased, hunted down, and ultimately executed. Arbery's family is calling for all three men arrested to face federal hate crime charges as well. For more, we're going to Georgia, to Atlanta, where we're joined by Carol Anderson, professor at Emory University, author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She has a new piece in The Guardian. It's headlined, In 1919, the state failed to protect black Americans. A century later, it's still failing. In a minute, we'll speak about the ongoing protests in defense of black lives. But let's begin, Professor Anderson, with Ahmaud Arbery and this unusual hearing, not like an arraignment hearing, but went on for hours. Can you respond to the testimony, the new information, and this whole issue of lynching in America, not 100 years ago, but today?
And thank you so much, Amy. What we saw on that tape was so contradictory to the statements that the McMichaels had originally made. And what it showed was them blocking him. It showed them hunting him down. It showed them executing him. And the fact that that tape was in the hands of law enforcement almost immediately, but nothing was done until protest, intense protest, erupted that thing out of the bowels of that law enforcement clique in Georgia, so that justice could begin to move down the pike. It begins to tell you about how unseemly, how corrupt, how corroded the system is, so that it takes protest to deal with issues of basic justice.
So you're in Georgia. Georgia is one of the few states in the country that doesn't have hate crimes laws. The family is calling for these men to be brought up on hate crime charges. Can you explain what this is about?
And one of the things is that for Georgia is that, you know, Georgia is one of the key lynching states. One of the most graphic lynchings happened here in Georgia, the one that Senator Cory Booker was talking about, which was Mary Turner, who had protested because her husband was lynched. And they were angry at this woman who was 8 months pregnant, who dared defy them. And they hung her upside down. They stripped her naked. They burned her. And then they cut the baby out of her stomach and stomped on the baby's head. That is Georgia. And so hate crimes becomes one of those very slippery ways that the state does not have to come to grips with the damage that it has done and that it continues to do. And I would just say on the whole issue of lynching, the fact that you had during George Floyd's memorial service, Rand Paul blocking an anti-lynching law named after Emmett Till also speaks volumes about where we are as a nation.
I want to issue a warning to our audience, because, Professor Anderson, I want to ask you about the story that contains just horrifying footage. Arrest warrants have been issued for 6 Atlanta police officers after they tased 2 black college students, dragging them from their car for allegedly violating the city's curfew Saturday night. One officer was filmed smashing the window of the car. Another slashed the car's tires. 2 of the officers have already been fired. The victims were a 20-year-old Spelman College student, Tania Pilgrim, and 22-year-old Morehouse College student, Messiah Young, who suffered a fractured wrist, needed 24 stitches, had a tase in his body for something like 5 hours after they shot him. This is Pilgrim and Young speaking Tuesday.
I hope every police officer who thinks it's okay to drag someone, beat someone, do all this stuff because they're cops, I hope they're all gonna be held accountable as well.
I feel a little safer now that these monsters are off of the street and no longer able to terrorize anyone else from this point on. So I think moving forward, we just need to, like Ms. Pilgrim said, we just need to make sure that all officers are held accountable and that there really is change moving forward within the culture of policing.
So that is Messiah Young and Tania Pilgrim. 2 kids, 1 at Morehouse, 1 at Spelman. You teach at Emory, Professor Anderson. The horror of this moment as you see the electricity just convulse Messiah. If 2 of the police officers were fired, all 6 arrest warrants were issued for them. Can you respond to this?
It absolutely had to happen that they are held accountable. When you see that film, one of the things that you see is that the car right in front of Messiah and has a white woman who is waving out the window and smiling. But the police converge on these wonderful, beautiful students and slash their tires, smash out their windows. And for what? For what? That's the thing that is actually convulsing across the nation, because you're asking for what? None of this looks like protect and serve. None of it. The trauma in that interview, you saw where that there was one moment where he's just saying that he almost has to disassociate himself from it because it was so traumatic, so violent. We do this to our people. What is that? Sorry, I was in tears when I saw that interview. I was horrified when I saw the original footage, and then in tears when I saw the interview.
And at the same time, you have Senator Rand Paul blocking anti-lynching legislation, right? He has proposed an amendment on Thursday that would weaken a bill making lynching a federal hate crime punishable by up to life in prison, a day before Senator Paul single-handedly stopped the legislation by denying its passage on unanimous consent. The bill is co-sponsored by the Senate's three African-Americans, Republican Tim Scott of South Carolina and Democrats Kamala Harris of California, Cory Booker of New Jersey.
But I am so raw today, of all days that we're doing this. I do not need my colleague, the senator from Kentucky, to tell me about one lynching in this country. I've stood in the museum in Montgomery, Alabama, and watched African-American families weeping at the stories of pregnant women lynched in this country and their babies ripped out of them.
That's New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. Carol Anderson, talk about the significance of this legislation passed almost unanimously in the House. And Rand Paul has stopped it in the Senate.
And you know, you think about it, anti-lynching legislation, the NAACP had tried since the 1920s to get federal anti-lynching legislation passed. And this is at that moment where you are seeing one horrific lynching after the next. There's a key moment in the mid-1930s where it's after the lynching of Claude Neal, the spectacle lynching. And that's where the lynching is actually advertised. And that is when they sell tickets. And Claude Neal is taken through a gauntlet of torture and tortured for hours and his body parts cut off. And he's forced to eat his own genitalia. And the NAACP is pressing hard for a federal anti-lynching bill. And two senators from the South, Jimmy Burns and Tom Connolly, blocked it. They mocked it. They laughed. They did almost a routine on the Senate floor, making lynching a joke. And so when I see Rand Paul talking about, well, we don't need to have this being, you know, so extensive, so we need to make sure that just when somebody is slapped, that's not called a lynching. That does violence to the thousands upon thousands of African Americans who have been lynched. That does enormous disrespect to the lives and to the families of those who have had to live under this terror without any kind of justice being brought.
Can you respond to the words that are often used in the corporate media, the riots, the looting that's going on? You've talked often about the state violence that is not so easily addressed.
And so we see this kind of false equivalence. It is the Philadelphia Inquirer's Buildings Matter too. The language of looting is a way to try to to distract and diffuse from the kind of bureaucratic violence that has rained down on Black communities. Bureaucratic violence in terms of militarizing the police. Bureaucratic violence in terms of underfunding public schools. Bureaucratic violence in terms of environmental toxins being poured into poor and Black communities. That kind of bureaucratic violence just gets elided over. And so one of the things when I wrote White Rage, I talked about how we focus so much on the flames that we miss the kindling. And the kindling is that bureaucratic violence that systematically destroys Black communities, that systematically erodes their citizenship. That is what we need to be paying attention to, or we're always going to see the flames. And so that looting tries to make that equivalence. It's a false equivalence. That language of looting, that language of when you're distracting from the peaceful protest. But when African Americans peacefully protested, like Colin Kaepernick, he was just vilified for somehow disrespecting the flag, when the real disrespect of the flag is the systematic destruction of Black people.
In your Guardian piece, Professor Anderson, you write, our current Attorney General Bill Barr does not appear to see injustice. Instead, he sounds much like his ancient predecessor, A. Mitchell Palmer. Explain.
So A. Mitchell Palmer was the Attorney General during 1919, the Red Summer of 1919. And there you had an eruption of anti-Black violence as Black veterans are coming back from World War I. Their work in the military as soldiers so disrupted what was the hierarchy of power, because it was like, wait a minute, they think they're citizens now? So you saw this violence erupt where Black people were hunted down and killed. One of the most horrific cases was in Elaine, Arkansas. And that is where Blacks were mobilizing to unionize because their wages were being stolen. You had this massive group of sheriffs and vigilantes and the U.S. Army coming in and just massacring Black people. The A. Mitchell Palmer didn't see that. What he saw, instead of people fighting for their constitutional rights, he said, these are these left-wing radicals. These are communists. And it launches what would become known as the Red Scare, this hunt for communists in every kind of movement for equality. What you see with Bill Barr by raising up this fictive Antifa organization that is out to destroy all that is good and right in America, where they can't even identify what the Antifa organization is. And Antifa stands for anti-fascist, fighting the fascist. But what we do have is the violence of the right wing, the violence where you have armed men storming into the Michigan State Capitol and threatening to kill the governor and yelling at law enforcement. But somehow that's not the kind of violence that Bill Barr is concerned with. So you get this mobilizing of federal forces to knock out progressive forces that are fighting for equality by using the threat of some outside agitator, some terrorist group. For A. Mitchell Palmer, communist. For Bill Barr, Antifa, whatever.
Bill Barr supposedly was the one who called for the police forces outside the White House to clear Lafayette Park for the president to walk forward with his chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of Defense for a photo op. And of course, President Trump once again yesterday tweeted about the protesters being terrorists. Before we end, I wanted to ask you about something people might not have noticed amidst the mass uprising this week. There were primaries around the country, people finding it extremely difficult to vote. Your latest book, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. This is an issue you cared immensely about, especially communities of color, so hard hit by these twin pandemics of police brutality and the pandemic. And the fact that the pandemic continues, people being afraid to go out to vote, that they have to choose voting over their own health, and the assault by the president on mail-in voting, though he does it himself. Talk about democracy, voting, what's going to happen in November if President Trump allows this election to happen at all.
And so what we're seeing is laying the groundwork for trying to erode these elections the same way you had voter suppression undermining the election in 2016. In 2016, because of voter suppression, because the U.S. Supreme Court had gutted the protections of the Voting Rights Act, you had a drop of 7% in black voter turnout. And remember that Trump won that election only by the Electoral College votes of 77,000 votes among three states. Voter suppression is lethal. It is deadly. And they're trying to replicate it again. So we're seeing things, for instance, like in Texas, where the Supreme Court and the Attorney General in Texas have said that the pandemic, a fear of COVID-19, is not a justifiable excuse to get an absentee ballot. Where you have in Kentucky, where because of the pandemic, they shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles. And then the Republican legislature said, oh, but in order to use an absentee ballot, you have to have a copy of your ID, your driver's license. So if you don't have a driver's license and you can't get a driver's license, how do you use your driver's license that you can't get in order to vote absentee? It's in Alabama, where the U.S. Department of Justice has weighed in on the side of Alabama to say that you must have a witness statement in the middle of a pandemic in order to use an absentee ballot. So what we're seeing here, in addition to what the U.S. Supreme Court did to those in Wisconsin in the middle of a pandemic, is to use the threat that is COVID-19 as a way to suppress voter turnout. But what is happening is that you have seen people who understand that the way that this regime has attacked their very being means that they're willing to crawl through glass. They're willing to stand in front of a COVID-19 firing squad and risk their lives in order to vote. Now, we have to ask ourselves—
We have 30 seconds, Professor Anderson.
What kind of society is that that makes people choose between their right to vote and their health? That's where we are right now in the United States of America.
Carol Anderson, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor at Emory University, author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, or her most recent book, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression's Destroying Our Democracy. And we'll link to your piece in The Guardian. When we come back, we speak with an African-American filmmaker. Police pepper sprayed him directly in the face as he was filming. We'll look at the militarization of police. Stay with us.
Keep on. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Hallelujah, hallelujah.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Keep on pushing by the impressions. This is the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to look at how President Trump's threatened a military response to nationwide protests and how police are already using military-grade weapons against demonstrators, in a minute we'll speak with the author of Badges Without Borders, how global counterinsurgency transformed American policing. But first, we're joined by Chris Frierson, an African-American documentary filmmaker, cameraman, who is filming a Black Lives Matter protest Saturday in Brooklyn, New York, when police moved in on demonstrators. And as he filmed, police pepper sprayed him directly in the face and lens. Chris kept filming as he struggled to the sidewalk, crying in agony from the pain. Within seconds, someone took his arm and guided him to volunteer medics who came to his aid. Yes, he filmed what happened to him, shared it with us. This is a clip. Listen closely. That's Chris Frierson, Peabody Award-winning documentary filmmaker, cameraman, filming a Black Lives Matter protest Saturday in Brooklyn for the award-winning documentary filmmaker Eugene Jarecki when police moved in on demonstrators. And as he filmed, they pepper-sprayed him in the face and lens. Within seconds, he filmed himself getting help from volunteer medics. Chris, it's nice to see you sitting up and that you are your eyes aren't closed. Talk about exactly what happened. Why did the police move in on you as you were directly filming?
What happened was it was a fairly peaceful protest. Nothing was going on. And as we moved through Brooklyn and the cops sort of started surrounding us. And at the drop of a hat, there was one woman in the crowd who I filmed who kind of ran in, threw a water bottle, and I turn around, and as soon as I turn around, there's a phalanx of police officers that just start running. They just start running towards a peaceful crowd and start spraying things. And I just saw this liquid flying at me, and it was too quick for me to even understand what was happening, but I was sort of, as you can see, I was incapacitated from that point on.
So, Chris, it's always described as this non-lethal way of crowd control. Describe what it feels like to be pepper sprayed in the face.
It's the second most painful experience I've ever had in my entire life. It is you just don't know what's going on. And I think that it's more than the pain. It's just not knowing what's happening all of a sudden, because you're robbed of your sight. You're robbed of your senses, and you have no clear idea what's happening. And luckily enough, as you see in that video, people came to my aid immediately. And if not for that, I don't know what I would have done.
I mean, it was amazing to see them, these grassroots medics on the ground. Explain right. What they were spraying into your face. They knew exactly what to do. They had their equipment right on them. And they, too, of course, can be right. Pepper sprayed.
Within seconds, they pulled me aside. I'm over on the curb and not in the street anymore. Saline solution in water. And it was more their words. Then, I mean, this sounds whatever, but it was their words that were just as helpful as the water and the milk that was like poured in my eyes. It was them just reassuring me that you can hear it, that it's temporary. You're going to be fine and everything's going to be okay. And that's sort of the power of what a lot of people in these protests, I think, that's the beauty in the spirit of these. It's people trying to help each other.
This wasn't generalized, the attack on you. I mean, the police shot you point blank range. You're a black man covering a Black Lives Matter protest. You have a major camera right there, and they just take you out with that pepper spray. This also in the midst of the pandemic, where African-American men are the most at risk of this respiratory attack on the system, right? COVID-19.
Right. I mean, I feel like I personally cannot say that they got me because of the color of my skin. I do know that that probably did not help. But what I saw when I saw those cops running towards me was I saw a weird fear in their eyes, even though there was nothing to be afraid of on their side, from my opinion. There was nothing really going on. So I kind of, you know, when I sort of internalized it, I'm not mad at that guy who did that. I just am not. I see him as someone who's a product of a systematic failure in a system and policing. And I think that that's the main thing that needs to be addressed. Like, I honestly am not mad at that guy. He just, that's what he's trained to do.
And Chris, as we wrap up,
that's unfortunate.
You... are right back out on the streets filming?
Yeah. I was out last night, peaceful, until it wasn't, and the day before, the same. But again, that goes back to the systematic failures of what the New York City police is, and I think cities across the country. It's these guys are workers, and these guys are largely being told to do things that are not appropriate.
Chris Ryerson, I want to thank you for joining us. And thank goodness that you're okay right now. Astounding that you're right out on the streets after being pepper sprayed directly in the face by police. Documentary filmmaker and cameraman. As we take this larger, turning from Chris's story to look at the militarization of the police force, the American Civil Liberties Union, Black Lives Matter, announced Thursday they're suing President Trump and Attorney General William Barr for authorizing a, quote, unprovoked and frankly criminal attack on protesters. That in Lafayette Park in Washington, D.C., where the National Guard and officers dressed in riot gear fired tear gas, rubber bullets and flashbangs to disperse peaceful protesters on Monday. So Trump could have his photo taken with a Bible in front of St. John's Episcopal Church. The bishop there criticized him, said it was completely inappropriate that they should use their church, that Trump should use their church as a backdrop. The lawsuit alleges the Trump administration violated protesters' constitutional rights of free speech and assembly. For more, we're going to Baltimore, Maryland, to speak with Stuart Schrader, associate director of the program in Racism, Immigration and Citizenship at Johns Hopkins University, author of the book Badges Without Borders, How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed American Policing. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk, Stuart, about this militarization of police?
Yeah. I think what we're seeing right now with the protests is a convergence of what I would consider three trends. The first is a long-term trend of police being trained to treat political protest and agitation as almost tantamount to a revolutionary situation, and therefore understanding their job of controlling protests is basically defending the republic. This has a long history. I covered in my book. It goes back throughout the 20th century. I think we can apply the term counterinsurgency to this, meaning that we're seeing a combination of social and political power being used to control political protest in addition to police power, even in the absence of a real insurgency or a real revolutionary situation. This is a long-standing trend. Another trend is what most of us would refer to as the militarization of policing. That means the use of military-style body armor and helmets, military-style trucks that are, you know, heavily armored, and, of course, the scary-looking military-style weaponry. Now, this type of material being in the hands of police increased after September 11th, 2001. But in the 1990s, under President Bill Clinton in 1997, Congress approved a program to transfer a lot of surplus material from the U.S. military into the hands of police. So this has been happening for quite a long time. Now, I think that it's important to note that we're seeing this material on our screens in the context of protest, but it's also been used quite widely in what we would consider ordinary policing situations, serving warrants and other types of routine activity. And beyond that, I think it's also important to note that, of course, George Floyd was not killed by a mine-resistant truck. George Floyd was killed by a police officer in ordinary gear who basically turned his body into a lethal weapon. So I think that when we talk about the militarization of policing, we have to also ask ourselves if getting rid of it, which is, I think, on the table in a new way right now, if we need to ask ourselves if getting rid of it is going to be enough. And then the third trend that I would point to is within the military, within the intellectuals and theorists of military strategy, there has been a turn toward urban space, turn toward cities. The idea here is that the U.S. military in coming decades is going to have to use its tactics in urban space, in the built environment of cities. This is a very sophisticated and detailed theoretical discourse that military strategists have developed. And it also entails a bunch of new tactics. And
very quickly, Stuart, before we wrap, and we just have 30 seconds, this use of tear gas, use of pepper spray in a time of COVID, of a pandemic that affects the respiratory system.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. Tear gas is a misnomer. It does not just make people cry. It makes them cough and gag. It's very harmful to the respiratory system, and it's making people cough and potentially spread the virus if they may not know that they're infected. It's really scary, and a lot of people are getting tear gas and are also getting arrested and then held in small confined spaces in jails and detention centers, and the risk of the spread of COVID is intense.
I want to thank you so much, Stuart Schrader, for being with us, author of Badges Without Borders, How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed American Policing. And that does it for today's broadcast. Today would have been Breonna Taylor's 27th birthday. She was shot to death by Louisville police inside her own apartment in Louisville, Kentucky, in March. The officers have not been charged. That does it for our show. To see our whole discussion of the case of Breonna Taylor, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Working with as few people on site as possible, majority of our amazing team working from home. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriano Contreras, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman.